So, this afternoon we return to the mindfulness of breathing, and now in the so-called classic method, according to the Theravada tradition, most specifically to Buddhaghosa in his classic text, the Visuddhimagga, or Path of Purification, where we're focusing on the sensations at the apertures of the nostrils. Right? And you'll recall that in the big picture, if one anticipates, well, what are the phases of this practice, and how does that alter the focus of your attention? I'm sure you'll recall that you begin with the preliminary sign, and that's right here, the apertures of the nostrils. After some time, very vague statement, a purely mental state, a mental appearance arises, the acquired sign, and then when you achieve shamatha, the counterpart sign. Now, one might ask, does that happen for everybody who engages in this practice? And is that account of these three types of sign, do you find this in all schools of Buddhism that really present mindfulness of breathing as a method for achieving shamatha? And the answer is no. To the best of my knowledge, the Buddha never mentioned acquired sign. He didn't ever mention any of these three signs. His teachings are pretty simple, right? Then he did the short breath, the long breath, the whole body, he said. He didn't actually say the whole body of the breath. He just said the whole body, and then soothing or calming in the composite of the body. Now, he unpacks that practice of mindfulness of breathing as mindfulness of breathing as a complete path from start to finish to achieve liberation, to become an arhat, all with mindfulness of breathing in 16 phases. So that's the teachings of the Buddha, 16 phases. The first four are shamatha. The last 12 are vipassana. And that takes you all the way, and then of course you have the fusion. That's why you have the shamatha first, so that it's there as backup, and then to be fused with the insights gleaned through the practice of vipassana. But nowhere in those 16 phases are there any references to preliminary sign, acquired sign, or counterpart sign. And moreover, Aidan and I had a very interesting conversation this morning, reminding me that in some of the earlier commentaries, and very formidable commentaries, within the Theravada tradition, once again, there are no references to that. And then I got curious to look at a translation I did 25 years ago from the Sanskrit of a text written about the same time as this text, the Visuddhimagga, 5th century. This one by now a Sangha of the Mahayana tradition, relying on Sanskrit sources. He has a very full chapter on mindfulness of breathing. And lo and behold, it breaks it up into 16 phases. And the first four phases are for shamatha, the last 12 phases are for vipassana, and nowhere. And this man is of comparable status to Buddhaghosa. Buddhaghosa for the Theravada tradition. It would be hard to say there's a more authoritative commentator in the whole Theravada tradition than Buddhaghosa. And within the Indian Mahayana tradition, there's hardly anybody to match a Sangha. One can say Nagarjuna. And then the list runs out pretty quickly. I mean, a lot of other formidable ones, Shantideva, Dignaga, Dhanakirti, and so forth. But Asanga is really way up there, right? And so in his presentation, and it's quite thorough, 16 phases culminating in liberation, nowhere does he mention acquired sign, counterpart sign. So what shall we draw from this? And that is clearly that the Buddhist teachings lend themselves to multiple interpretations, and multiple interpretations, I'm going to draw this conclusion, multiple interpretations worked. They worked. You know, I mean, it's all certainly possible that some interpretation didn't work, but when it comes from a person of the stature of Buddhaghosa or Asanga and so forth, I think it's a pretty reasonable conjecture. They're probably teaching something that really worked. Now, another interesting point, I just reviewed it, when it comes to that phase, that third phase, long breath, short breath, and then attending the whole body, Asanga did not say the whole body of the breath. He said the whole body where you experience the prana, the air coming through your pores. And actually he was really referring to being aware of your full whole body, but not just big, you know, rise and fall of, you know, muscles in your belly, getting really, really subtle. Really, really subtle. So might it be possible to achieve shamatha, and by that mean we explicitly mean access to the first jhana, without an acquired sign arising? Might that be possible? I suspect so. Otherwise, probably the Buddha would have mentioned the acquired sign. Asanga would have mentioned the quiet sign. These are brilliant contemplatives. I mean, a Buddhist Buddha. Asanga was a very accomplished yogi. So what might that entail, though, if we try to imagine it? I mean, just a bit down the road a little bit. What that how might that work if we know from Asanga and other great accomplished masters like Tsongkhapa that as long as you're still focusing your attention in the desire realm, you won't transcend it. You won't lift up anchor, and move your attention over the form realm if you've dropped your anger in the desire realm. That's kind of just common sense. How might this work? Well, let's try this one on for size. Imagine you're there focusing on the breath. And your awareness is getting subtler and subtler as the whole system is calming down from the long in and out breaths to short and shorter and shorter. The whole system just getting fine tuned and it's approaching such equilibrium that the breathing stops altogether. Now, on that point, in fact, there's uniformity. Theravada tradition, multiple schools, multiple treatises and commentaries, the Mahayana and so forth. On this point, there is conformity. Achieve the fourth jhana. Now that's way up there. But achieve the fourth jhana. Your breathing flatlines. It's zero. And it can be for hours, days, or even weeks. And no brain damage. Now on that one, there's just not much wiggle room. That is very broad consensus. So that one seems to be like an invariant, which suggests that achieving the fourth jhana is a very, very formidable state of samadhi. And people nowadays who want to take that label, fourth jhana, and bring it down to something much lesser, I think they're doing something, frankly, corrupt. That is, people just don't like having things so many above them, so they just want to pull it down to their size. And that happens a lot. And when it comes to access to the first jhana, there's an interesting point here from Dujom Lingba, when he's talking about what's it like, what do people say when their coarse mind has dissolved into the substrate consciousness? So you've got the description, you have some sense of it, at least conceptually. And he said, and how he's speaking from the Tibetan tradition. As a grand master, 13 of his disciples achieve rainbow bodies, so he's pretty formidable. And I think we can say he can speak with some authority. And when he describes a state, which he describes with tremendous clarity, and this is now published in the book Stilling the Mind, with his core commentary, and then whatever I can add to it. But his core presentation is what's really central there. He describes it in just radiant clarity. I mean, it's just, there it is. This is people's experience. And it has been going on for centuries. And then he says, now once a yogi slips into that, the whole world is imploded, bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality, and all of that. When people come out of it, how do they describe? What kind of labels do they give to what they've just experienced? And he said, oh, some people call this non-meditation, as in an advanced state of Mahamudra. Some people call it the one taste of samsara nirvana. Some people call it, you know, this, that, and the other thing. In other words, they too, these are Tibetan yogis, will take the most rarefied, the most advanced states of samadhi in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen tradition, and then say, I can't stand it being way up there. I'm going to take it right down here. Oh, good. I'm a Vijayadhara now. Now I've realized Rigpa. And he said, whatever you call it, what I call it is you've ascertained the essential nature of the mind, which is the conventional nature of the mind. The substrate consciousness. Just that. Don't get carried away. Penjen Losan Shukigansen, the tutor of the fifth Dalai Lama, another formidable yogi, first-rate yogi, he says the same thing. He's speaking about now settling the mind in its natural state, awareness of awareness, and when you come to the culmination, he said some people just get carried away. They say this is emptiness, this is Rigpa, this is Buddha nature. He said what I call it, you've just to realize the essential nature of the mind, the conventional essential nature of the mind. It's luminosity, it's cognizance. Congratulations. Don't get carried away. You've not even begun Vipassana yet, let alone come to the culmination. You've not even become Mahamudra, you've not even started Mahamudra yet. Don't get carried away. Right? So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And then knowing their different strategies. So now how might it work? Since Tsongkhapa never mentioned a choir sign. I've never seen it in any Tibetan literature. We've got a lot of literature. I've never seen it anywhere. And Asanga, there a lot of people are drawing on Asanga. That is a lot of the Tibetan yogis and pundits. And it's no, I just read it. I mean, I translated the whole thing from Sanskrit and Tibetan. Oh. Back then, my brain really worked. I could read some Sanskrit back then. And it's just nowhere there. There's just no reference to any of these acquired signs. And so what might happen? And that is, just as an analogy, a lot of you have done some Vajrayana practice, where at the end of the sadhana, see if this rings a bell, at the end of the sadhana, you imagine the formless realm, the form realm, the desire realm, all of these going, withdrawing into, dissolving into your body. Right? And then, top down, bottom up, your whole body dissolving into seed syllable. Right? Some erect seed syllable, like ri or hung or something like that. And then, that's the sound effects, you need to know that. And that is, you have this dissolution from bottom up. Bottom up, until it goes into the tikle, the bindu, just a singularity, a single point, a dimensionless little single point, and then that just goes. I'm not quite sure it makes that sound, but, you know, maybe. And it just dissolves into emptiness. Well, what this is like is, all your experience of the desire realm, dissolving into form realm. Seed syllable. Seed syllable dissolving into the point. A dimensionless point. Formless realm. And then the formless realm dissolving into emptiness. Or the primordial non-duality of emptiness and rigpa. And so, just possibly, this is only an analogy, of course, but that's true, when I just said, I think that's true of Vajrayana practice. Very, very classic. Perhaps not only in an analogous way, not at all identical, but just in an analogous way. As practicing mindfulness of breathing comes into the body, and then it just gets subtler and subtler and subtler. Vanishingly subtle. Your mind totally drawn into these extremely subtle tactile sensations of the breath. Right up there through stage 9, and you're holding on by a fingernail to the desire realm. And then you release it. And then your mind slips over into shamatha, over to the threshold to the form realm. Now the descriptions, and I've read them pretty carefully, the descriptions of this access to the first jhana, as we find in the Theravada literature and then in the Indo-Tibetan, the Sanskrit-based literature, as far as I can tell, they're very, very similar, and I would say, for all practical purposes, they are identical. I would say the experience is identical. The interpretations vary only slightly. And the Tibetans have really kept this one alive. I just can't say. I've heard different things about the Theravada tradition. How really robust, how alive was their contemplative tradition in Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and so forth in the 16th century, the 17th century, 18th century. I've heard some scholars say it went flat for quite a long time there. It was pretty much study and ritual, keep your precepts, study, ritual, because they have this strong sense, and it is a strong sense in the Theravada tradition, that the Dharma was declining by big 500-year chunks, and that the period of gaining realization and even achieving jhana was finished, so now maintain a good scholarly tradition, well, at least keep your vows, and then, you know, then say bye-bye to Buddha Dharma after some centuries have gone by. So I've heard some say that, and I'm not enough of a scholar to be able to say yes or no. I don't have any, but I have heard that. I've seen a lot of indications that the kind of the revival of Vipassana within the Theravada tradition is very much of a 20th century event. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Ubekin, for example, Mahasi Sayadaw, and so forth. I think there's overwhelming evidence that in the Tibetan tradition, there was no die-out period. I mean, there was a dip back in, the 9th century, when it was pretty much obliterated under King Langdharma. But then, it didn't get completely obliterated, and then there was this massive resurgence with Atisha and Rinzhen Sambo, and so forth and so on, from the 11th century onwards. And I think there's overwhelming evidence that this has been a powerfully dynamic, vital, and continuous tradition for the last millennium. I think the historical evidence thing is very, very strong there. And so I would say, with great deal of confidence, for the last 1,000 years in Tibet, every single generation, there have been people who have achieved shamatha. And I would say with great confidence, there are now alive people who have achieved shamatha, as it's described in these 9 stages that you find in the Attention Revolution, which is based upon pretty darn good sources. Some practicing by way of a mental image, some practicing by way of, Mahamudra, settling the mind, awareness of awareness, and so on. And what they say, and there's a lot of uniformity once again, is when you achieve shamatha as an access to the first jhana, your senses have completely imploded, the mind is free of even subtle laxity and excitation, you have this tremendous suppleness, this buoyancy, a natural bliss that goes along with the experience. You can tap into whenever you like. And in between sessions, your mind is radiantly healthy, extremely healthy. The lightness of the body, the clarity of your dream life, the overall virtuousness, the natural virtuousness of your mind, like you're having a terrific psychological immune system, such that you're not immune to mental afflictions. But they've got a really tough job to really dominate your mind. Whenever I say that, an image comes to mind. You've all seen it, at least in film, like nature films, of salmon, you know, when they're going to spawn, and they're having to jump up those rapids, and, you know, they jump and then they fall back, and they jump and they fall back, and they jump, and a grizzly bear chomps them, and then they get up to another, and then they have to jump again, and when they finally get up to where they can spawn, their bodies, these four poor female, well, I guess both of them, because the other one, the males have to, you know, fertilize the eggs, but their bodies are so beat up by the time they get there. I mean, they lay their eggs and they just go, and none of this is anybody's food. You know, it's such a tough job for them to get upstream. It's really, really tough. And they get beaten up, even if they don't get eaten. They get beaten up by all the rocks and so forth. So why did he go into that? There's a real good reason. I don't just dither on for no reason. I dither on for good reasons. The salmon are your mental afflictions. The salmon trying to swim upstream, they're your mental afflictions. Once you've achieved shamatha, the flow of your mind is the opposite direction. Virtue arises really, really easily. Mental afflictions, they may be able to get up there and spawn, but man, they get beat up in the process. Because your mind is so healthy. So I would simply say this is true. And yogis for generations have been saying you get there at least 4 hours, effortless. So one can say, oh, they didn't really mean it, they didn't really mean it. All one is really saying is, I can't imagine it, therefore it can't be true, it must be less. I don't think that has a whole lot of legitimacy to it. But rather look at the 9 stages, and then rather than trying to believe or not believe, or is this really this and that, and the fourth jhana and blah, 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 say, okay, look, how about from stage 1 to stage 2? Are the teachings any good? Are the practices effective? Is this helping my mind or not? Now, those are practical questions. And then you can find out. In 8 weeks, you can find out whether stage 2 is possible. I think so. At least get a little taste. A little tip of the tongue. Ooh, there was stage 2. I think I had a mind for 1 minute at a stretch. It was very cool. And then when you've gone home, you'll think, those were the good old days. When I had a mind for a minute at a stretch. So on these points, commonality of access to the first jhana, differences in methods of mindfulness of breathing, a lot of commonality in terms of settling the mind in its natural state, and I think there are deep, deep parallels in awareness of awareness and the Buddha's own teachings on the Vijnanakasina, focusing on the emblem of consciousness self. I think those parallels are very, very deep. But it raises one final point, and that is, this is going to be a big one, so don't hold your breath. And that is, you know, if we're really trying to understand the teachings of the Buddha, where do we look? Should we look to a Sangha? Should we look just to the Pali Canon? Well, what about the Sanskrit? So the Sanskrit Canon, what about all those cool texts in Sanskrit? To just Buddhaghosa? How about him? He's a big authority. Or how about a Sangha? He wrote a lot of commentaries. How about Tsongkhapa, brilliant Tsongkhapa, or Longchen Rachampa, or Sakyapandita? How about Marpa, the great translator? How about the Dalai Lama? Or how about Dujom Lingma? So, you know, who's going to be our refuge? Coming back to that issue. If you'd really like to follow the path revealed by the Buddha, which Buddha, which canon, which language, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Chinese, Japanese, Pali, which one? Which one are you going to rely upon? Which one are you going to entrust yourself to? And are you going to trust yourself only to the earliest texts and consider everybody else kind of screwed up? And you're going to look with clairvoyant vision through 2,500 years or 2,000 years and get the real picture, because nobody between you and them really got it right. I would say you have a lot of chutzpah if you draw that conclusion. Buddhist chutzpah. It's nothing like Buddhist chutzpah. You know? And it does bring to mind, I think, a very important, very short story from the Pali Canon of Buddha walking through a forest with his attendant Ananda. I don't know the whole context of it, but the gist of it is very simple. And that is, the issue just came up, what is the extent of the Tathagata's wisdom? How much can he see? How much can a Buddha perceive? How much does the Buddha know? And this issue came up, and the Buddha turned to Ananda, picked up one leaf from the forest floor. Maybe it was fall, and it was just covered with leaves. Picked up one leaf, and he said, Ananda, the teachings that I actually relay to others, the knowledge that I have, that I relay to others, to set forth the path to liberation, it's like one leaf. The scope of reality, the range of reality of which I'm directly aware, is like all the leaves in the forest. So by any account, the scope of the Buddhist teachings, the recorded teachings in the Pali Canon, the Sanskrit, the Chinese Agamas, and so forth, is very, very large. But he's saying that's one leaf. But now let's speculate a little bit. I think I've been speaking as a fairly decent scholar thus far. Speculate a little bit. What was the Buddhist intent? What was the Buddhist intent that during the 45 or so years that he taught, that he would say everything that anybody should ever need to know about the path to liberation? And when he died, the iron doors of the Buddhist canon or the Buddhist teachings come crashing down. The Buddha no longer speaks. The Buddha now is silent eternally. Having practiced for three countless eons and taught for 45 years, as they say in the cartoon, that's all, folks. You know, is that it? Is that the final thing? Right? And that's a possibility. There are practitioners and scholars that see everything after that was kind of deformation, degradation, interpretation, lower scale, skip everything after that, just the Pali Canon. One way of looking at it. I understand the mentality, but it does set oneself up above everyone who's come after the Buddha prior to oneself, feeling none of them got it right. But from the 21st century vantage point, after all, I'm a moderner. Somehow I have especially privileged access to what the Buddha really meant. Maybe, but I find that a bit extreme chutzpah. But did the Buddha really mean for us to simply, this is speculation, it's a question, not an answer, but did he mean for those who followed him to stop? I mean, again, the door comes down. That's all I ever had to say. Even though I may have knowledge of all the leaves in the forest, that's the one leaf you get, and don't step beyond that. It's a possibility. Some people believe that. I don't. I don't believe that. In the Pali Canon, there's just an extraordinarily radiantly clear presentation of the three marks of existence, of impermanence, dukkha, and non-self. Radiantly clear. The four satipatthana, radiantly clear. The five skandhas, many, many other aspects. Dependent origination, the 12 links, and so forth. Some aspects in that Pali Canon are just, so many aspects, are really, really clear. And then some, as one reads carefully, one sees they seem more like seeds than a full-blown tree. I'll give an example. The Buddha referred to phenomena being like a chariot. I can't quote it directly, but I do have the source. It comes in Mind and the Balance. I'll show you exactly the source in the Pali Canon. Where phenomena, all phenomena are like a chariot. And he takes it apart. And which part, you know, is it the wheels? Is it the axle? Is it the chair? So forth. Which part of the, and he does basically an ontological analysis of a chariot. And he says, if you're looking for the chariot among the parts, or even the compilation of the parts, you don't find it. A chariot is a name. And one finds other intimations of that as well. Teachings on emptiness, teachings not only on the emptiness of some inherent personal ego, but in fact an emptiness of svabhava, an emptiness of all phenomena being empty of their own names. Very good scholar. I met him for the first time. Very happy to have met him. Honored to have met him. Analayu Bhikkhu. he and I were at a conference together. Spent some really lovely time together. First rate scholar. Boy, his language skills are amazing. Amazing. I don't even compare to his. He's writing a whole paper, I think a long paper, maybe even turned into a book on the teachings on emptiness in the Pali Canon. And he's really going back to the canon. He doesn't have a whole lot of, how do you say, interest in Buddhaghosa or the much later writings. Really focusing on some of the earliest, the Chinese Agamas, the Pali Canon, the Nikayas, and so forth. And I read his paper. And it's very good, of course. He's an outstanding scholar. And what I bring away from it is that all these phenomena are empty of the names that we attribute to them. The chariot is not already a chariot. It doesn't label itself. So when we attend to a chariot, it's empty of that label. Push that one a little bit. And that is when you consider, in the scene, when you just let there be just the scene, in the felt, the tactily touched, there's just the touched. When you approach the chariot, all you're really getting is an array of appearances, right? I mean, you may knock on it and hear the sound of the chariot when you knock on it. You can obviously see it. You have visual appearances. Maybe you can smell the wood, get more appearances. In the smell, that would be just the smell and so forth and so on. And then we have the chariot that has a color, that has a shape, that has a texture, that has a fragrance. Maybe if you're a termite, it has a taste too. Then you nibble away the chariot. It's a taste of a chariot. Oh, the chariot has that taste. Ah, mahogany. Whatever it is. But what is that phenomenon, the chariot, that has these appearances as its attributes? It now is the owner, that which has the attributes. How did that get in there? That entity out there that has appearances. And is it anything other than the label? And if the chariot is empty of label, isn't the chariot also empty of chariot? As something existing from its own side, prior to and independent of any labeling. So what I'm suggesting here, and I do believe it's true, is that in the Pali Canon, there are some very powerful seeds of teachings on the perfection of wisdom, of emptiness, emptiness of inherent nature. And I give a number of sources in this book, Mind in the Balance. It's there. But one can easily miss it, overlook it, or just kind of skim right over it, or say, oh, that's interesting, and move right on. You take those seeds, though, put those seeds, plunk those over into the Mahayana tradition, and suddenly you've got a 50-meter redwood tree cropping up. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutra is in 100,000 verses. That's a full-blown tree. The seeds, I believe, and there's a strong conviction, are right there in the Pali Canon. But now, in terms of, you know, how Buddha Dhamma unfolded, how it came into the public domain, well, what's pretty clear is the Mahayana as a public, Mahayana teachings, the perfection of wisdom, the six perfections, the bodhisattva way of life, bodhicitta, and so forth, in terms of becoming what's called mangchu, public dharma, and that is, everybody knows in society, anybody who's interested, oh, these teachings are now available. Well, that was some hundreds of years after the Buddha. I think there's a lot of consensus on that, in terms of becoming public teaching. The Mahayana interpretation of that was that during the time of the Buddha, for some centuries after that, just the zeitgeist, Indian culture, wasn't as a whole ready for that dimension of teaching yet. But over a few centuries, there's an evolution of society, transformation, call it whatever you like, and then when these teachings came out, the perfection of wisdom, the teachings on the bodhisattva way of life and so forth, boy, when they hit like a meteor with shockwaves going on. They made it big really quickly. The Mahayana teachings spread all the way down to Sri Lanka, way down to Southeast Asia, out to Indonesia. They spread all the way up to Afghanistan, up into Central Asia, up to Khotan eventually, and farther north. They made a hit. They really made a hit. But it was like, you know, wait. Kaboom, and then, you know, really flowed out. It made a big impact. And then we see the real flowering of these seeds, the germination and the flowering of these seeds that were there all along, but now manifesting much more fully, explicitly, in tremendous detail. And then there are references to the bodhisattva, and that there are multiple bodhisattvas throughout, you know, throughout history. because every Buddha was a Bodhisattva. But in the Pali Canon, where are the elaborate teachings? How do you become a Bodhisattva? What exactly are the unique trainings you as a Bodhisattva will engage in that an Arhat or an Arhat in training doesn't engage in? What are the phases of development? How does your mind, evolve? That's not there. Not in elaborate detail. I mean, it's there a little, skimpy here, skimpy there. Well, come over to the Mahayana Sutras and oh, it's laid out in full detail. So the Mahayanas would say, yeah, those were there all along. It just wasn't ripe for them to come out. And then it was. But they are teachings of the Buddha. Because why would a person practice for three countless eons to become a Buddha and then not teach other people how to become a Buddha? Does that really make sense? You know, I mean, this is what I became, but I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to keep it to myself. You only get to become Arhat, but I become Buddha. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. You know, if you become a Buddha, you're going to be generous with those teachings. Well, yes, in the Mahayana canon, it's there. Let's move right along to, how about Rigpa, pristine awareness, primordial consciousness? I found some very interesting, one in particular, one teaching of the Buddha. Speaking of non-manifestive consciousness, addressing the question for which normally his response was noble silence, depending on who he is speaking with. The question is, what happens to an arhat after an arhat dies? So, arhat's mind is completely pure. Mental afflictions irreversibly purified. Gets old, dies. No more rebirth. That's the bottom line. No more rebirth. No more karma throwing that person into the next rebirth. Finished. Now what? Okay, what happened? I mean, what happened? You know, like, really, it's a legitimate question. You know, if this is the culmination, is it annihilation? Is that what? I mean, was the whole of samsara all there just so you could make it stop and become obliterated? No. Is it annihilation? No. Oh, not annihilation. Good, that's a relief. So, what's left? Generally, noble silence. Noble silence. But not always. There's this one case where he speaks of non-manifestive consciousness, unborn, unconditioned. Clearly, it's open to interpretation. I do not mean to imply there's only one way of interpreting it. But, I've relied on some pretty good sources. Very competent scholars of the Pali Canon, Theravada Buddhism, which I'm not, but I rely upon people who are, suggestive of there being a dimension of consciousness that is unborn, unconditioned, non-manifested, that is to say, invisible to any dimension of consciousness other than itself. Invisible, of course, to coarse mind, but also invisible to subtle mind, to bhavanga. Invisible to a person who is still walking around operating out of a subtle mind, even a subtle mind, invisible to all dimensions of consciousness but itself. Unborn. And that's what's left. An unborn, non-manifestive, unconditioned, unceasing, characterized by immutable bliss. Because nirvana is bliss. It doesn't stop when you die. So that's there. It's open to interpretation. I'm going to interpret it. Which means I could be completely wrong, but hopefully not foolish. If that's what's left, and you can see the source, you can interpret it for yourself, then that unborn consciousness, that's all that remains, let's say a minute after the arhat has passed away, or 1 second for that matter, but let's give it a minute. The arhat's now dead. They're ready. The decomposition process has started. So it's a dead arhat. And so what's left? Unconditioned consciousness. Unborn consciousness. And it's quite clearly, it's not somebody else's consciousness. You don't lose yours and then get God's or some other Buddha's or somebody else's. There's no grounds for that interpretation. So what you're getting isn't somebody else's. Which means, of course, in a way, it's got to be yours. And if that's all that's left 1 minute after you pass away as an arhat, and it's unborn, 1 minute after you've passed away, and it's unborn, it must be present 1 minute before you pass away. If it's unborn, unborn means it has no beginning, right? It's unconditioned. It's out of time. It's beyond time. Immutable. But this means it's already present there where the arhat is 1 minute before she dies. But if it's there 1 minute before she dies, it was also there 10 years before she dies. Which means it was also there before she became stream enterer. Which means it was already there 10 lifetimes ago. I mean, if it's unborn, we have to take that seriously. Unborn means it's not born at any time in history. Which means that that unconditioned dimension of consciousness was there all along. And its nature is one of immutable bliss, unconditioned. Waiting to be unveiled. Waiting to know itself. Primordial. And it is consciousness. Gosh, what should we call it? How about primordial consciousness? How about Tathagatagarbha? How about Buddha nature? How about pristine awareness? Or are there two unconditioned consciousnesses? The Pali one and the Sanskrit. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. There would be two, they kind of bump into each other and say, there's not enough room in here for both of us. One of you, what do you got, has to leave. You leave. No, you leave. No, I was here first. Okay. Well, whatever. That doesn't make any sense to me. I suspect, as in the case of Theravada practitioners realizing Bhavanga, calling it, interpreting it Bhavanga, Dzogchen practitioners achieving Shamatha and calling and experiencing something called substrate consciousness, my strong conviction is they're experiencing exactly the same thing. And when they come out of the experience and make sense of it within the framework with which they're familiar, there can be subtle variations on the interpretation. That's my sense. And that's also my sense, that when the Buddha spoke of this unconditioned, non-manifest of consciousness that's there after an arhat dies, I think he's not referring to anything other than pristine awareness. So when did the Buddha stop teaching? The teachings on Dzogchen? It's difficult to see, but back to Prahavajra. Difficult. How long did he live? 1,000 years, something like that. Difficult. They've been around for a long time, put it that way. In terms of manifesting in this world, in terms of becoming really public dharma, that is, a lot of people know Dzogchen, the word may actually mean something. Well, that's been around for more than 1,000 years, easily. Padmasambhava is 1,200 years, and he didn't invent it. Like, one of his teachers was a Chinese, Sri Singha, Chinese. But when did the Buddha stop teaching? We have whole systems, elaborate systems, I referred to one of them, the Kala Chakra. The most complex, the most encompassing, the most, I mean, kind of awe-inspiring, integrated system within all of Vajrayana. As it covers everything from embryology to cosmology, stage of generation, stage of completion, language and mathematics, all kinds of things, and all integrated there. It's just mind-boggling system and very difficult to learn. And the practice is also very complex. Those teachings didn't become public in our world until the 11th century. And that's a long time to wait. That's the last big Vajrayana system, highest yoga tantra system, Anuttara yoga system, that became public, and was attributed to the historical Buddha. And it is. It is attributed to the historical Buddha. Buddha taught that during his lifetime. In a very mystical kind of virtual kind of way, but nevertheless it's attributed to the Buddha Shakyamuni. But didn't become public dharma in our world until 1500 years or so after he passed away. But remarkably, and I do find this quite astonishing, that 1,500 years after the Buddha had passed away, when you have these tremendous monastic universities like Vikramashila and Nalanda, these extraordinary pundits, vast erudition, I mean, they know the Buddha Dharma inside and out. They read Pali, Sanskrit, Prakrit, and so forth and so on. Tremendous knowledge. I mean, they really know Buddha Dharma. People like Naropa, Atisha, and so forth. Boy, they were consummate masters. And then along comes when they, you know, they figure, okay, we got 1500 years of Buddhism, we got Guhyasamaja, we've got these multiple Vajrayana systems and so forth. And then seemingly out of the blue, again, 1500 years after the Buddha's passing away, comes the Kala Chakra. And one by one, Atisha and so forth and so on, they accept it. Oh yeah, this is authentic. And they took it right in as authentic teachings of the Buddha himself. That's remarkable. Imagine in the 15th century of the Common Era, somebody discovering some scriptures in North Africa that are really, really different than the four Gospels in the Christian New Testament. Really different. And this is by the time the Roman Catholic Church is extremely well established, right? 15th century. Very well established. And somebody says, we found these really cool texts, found it in a cave someplace. And these are teachings of Jesus. And they're really different from what you know about. And the Pope said, you betcha. And the Cardinal says, yowza. Bring it on in. We're rewriting the Bible. Add three more chapters. Could have happened. Didn't happen. 1949 or so, maybe it was 1945, something around there, the Nag Hammadi scriptures were discovered in a cave in Egypt. Whole bunch of them, these Gnostic scriptures. It's safe to say they've not been incorporated into the Christian New Testament. You know. Might have been, but weren't. They're Gnostic. Well, we come over to the Dzogchen tradition. Kala Chakra coming in. Gnostic, big-time Gnostic, becoming 1,500 years after the Buddha. But, so there we are, 11th century. But then we go further on, and then we find as the kind of the weight, the gravitational center of Mahayana Vajrayana Buddhism moving from India to Tibet. Mahayana Vajrayana. It went to Tibet more than any other place. That's a historical fact. That as it's flourishing there over the last millennium, then we find generation after generation following Padmasambhava in the 8th century. We have these, especially in the Dzogchen tradition, not confined to it by any means, but especially there, most explicitly there, generation after yet, generation of these Tertön, these treasure revealers, cracking open a boulder someplace in eastern Tibet, in where a lot of people are watching, cracking open a boulder and finding inside the boulder a sacred text, pulling out and say, oh, these are teaching Padmasambhava. Centuries after he passed away. This has happened even recently. That's called an earth dharma, an earth treasure. One of these teachings, again, like a time capsule, that Padmasambhava slipped off someplace and said, you're not ready yet. This is just the 8th century, but give it a few centuries. Let Tibetan culture here brew for a while, and at some point in the future the time will be ripe, and then I'll send one of my emissaries and they're going to break open that boulder and you'll get the teachings then, and then they'll become public teachings. That's happened time and time again. Natural liberation is one example of that. I think it came out of the inside of a boulder, as I recall, by Kamalingpa. And it's not just going back to Padmasambhava, in some cases going right back to primordial Buddha. I'll end on this note. I said it would be long. This is the end. Dujum Lingpa is one of many. He's not unique, but he is spectacular, writing in the 19th century. I don't know, and now just flat out, I do not know at all, whether he found any earth dharma, you know, going into the earth or into a boulder or what have you, and finding something physical. He may have. I just don't know. I'm not that much of a scholar. But what I do know is his revelation of a number of gongter, mind treasures, where he went deeply into samadhi, not just shamatha, but way beyond shamatha, into state regeneration practice and Dzogchen practice, into deep realization. And out of that deep realization, as he tapped into Rigpa, then having, again, something just emerged spontaneously. Pardon me, I want to say something really trivial. But you must have seen Star Wars 1, right? At least when you were a kid. You remember when that Princess Leia, and then Princess Leia just popped out like a holographic and started talking? Remember that? That was a dharma. Oh, there we go. But there she is, and she's relaying a message, but it's all holographic. But there it is. She just popped out and giving some important information. pardon the triviality of it, but it's something like that. And that is, he went into a virtual reality, out of his mind stream popped out, not Princess Leia, but somebody much cooler. And that is Samantabhadra, manifesting in one of the various manifestations of Padmasambhava, with a whole entourage of disciples, and then they had a conversation that went on for 400 pages. And Dujonengwa just wrote it all down. Kept it for, 10, 12, 14 years. And then felt, okay, I received it, but now everybody else is ready. And then he made it public. It's called a mind treasure. It's called the Vajra Essence. And then there were other ones, shorter ones, shorter ones. So within the tradition, from inside Dzogchen, since he was such an accomplished master in terms of his own realization, that was widely recognized, and such an almost unbelievably consummate teacher in leading other people to rainbow body, to direct realization of Rigpa, then it's considered he's authentic, and what he was offering was not just expressions of his own brilliance as this 19th century figure, not just the passed on transmitted brilliance of Padmasambhava from what, 1,000 years earlier, but actually teachings from the Buddha. Not historical Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni, Samantabhadra, primordial Buddha. And so the Buddha continues to talk, continues to teach, and the Dharma continues to unfold. And that's happening to this day. I had the good fortune of receiving teachings on Lerab Nyingma's text, the Chetsen Yingtig, from one accomplished Tibetan yogi named Kempo Jigme Pinsol, considered to be a Derdun, treasure revealer. And when he visited his own Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, I heard this, and I'm quite sure it's true. He visited him. So these two great lamas, one accomplished yogi from Tibet, the other his holiness, one walked into the other's presence. And while they were there, he said something like, "Oh, your holiness, I'm getting a transmission." And his holiness said, "And the words I'm making up, the gist of it, this is what really occurred." His holiness said, "Oh, then hold it, I'll take notes." And then he had a treasure, a mind treasure, come right through while he was with the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama was the scribe. Right? Teachings of the Buddha from Kempo Jigme Pinsol to the Dalai Lama. All about 10, 15, 20 years ago. So does the Buddha continue to teach? Yeah. Teaches from the outside, when we receive teachings from great masters like that. Teaches from the inside, when you tap into that depth yourself. Maybe something like that. So, meanwhile, as they say in the American movies, meanwhile, back on the ranch, we're going to practice mindfulness of breathing. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states as you've done before. And then as we begin the classic practice within the Theravada tradition, see that all the muscles of your face remain soft, loose, relaxed, your eyes soft, unfocused, forehead spacious. And within that spaciousness, direct your attention like a laser, targeting the point right at the apertures of your nostrils or just above the upper lip. Like a laser in the sense of being finely focused, but light, like a butterfly landing on a flower, a soft touch, highly focused, and a soft touch. Just close enough to clearly detect the sensations of the in and out passage of the breath. See that your breath flows effortlessly at all times. And note that at all times there is something there to detect, something to know, even if it's just the background vibration, tingling, that is present in the target area, even between breaths. And relaxing deeply with every out-breath, gently arousing with each in-breath, attend to the whole body of the breath, the full course of inhalation and exhalation, gently, persistently. Let this be a full-time job, filling the space of your awareness, like a pot with water, with the ongoing flow of the sensations of in and out breath. And insofar as you find it helpful, you may punctuate this flow of mindfulness with counting the breaths. But do it only insofar as you find it helpful to maintain stability of attention. If at any time the breath becomes so subtle that you can no longer detect the sensations, attend more closely. They're there, you're just not seeing them. Arouse the vividness of your attention and do so synergistically. Vividness to stability, relaxation, relaxation to stability, to vividness. The task is to maintain continuity to the best of your ability of mindfulness and to monitor the flow of mindfulness with introspection. But introspection also has the task periodically to check up on the body to see that it's still subtle in its natural state, the breathing flowing in its natural rhythm, and then monitoring the flow of the mind. Recognizing as quickly as possible the imbalances of laxity and excitation, and swiftly applying the appropriate remedies. With this in mind, bearing this in mind, let's continue practicing now in silence. Oh, not so. Quite a bit of mail is built up, so tomorrow I better cut short any other commentary. Could I say something a bit more about the relationship between substrate consciousness and Buddha nature? Yeah, this will come up repeatedly. This will come up again and again over the next 4.5 weeks or so. Very simply put, the substrate consciousness, your substrate consciousness, is the basis for your samsara. And your pristine awareness is the basis of the whole of samsara and nirvana. One is conditioned, one is beyond conditioned. One is the one taste, the Buddha nature being the one taste of the whole of samsara and nirvana. Substrate consciousness, that's just the foundation from which all the psyches emerge from lifetime to lifetime. In loving kindness meditation, you mentioned the white orb of our heart is our Buddha nature. No, not really. I mean, the Buddha nature is not white, and it's not spherical. This is a symbol. This is a symbol. So this radiant incandescent orb of light at the heart is a symbol of Buddha nature. If this energy, or Buddha nature is not energy, Buddha nature is consciousness, but it's conjoined with the Yishiki Lung, which is the energy of primordial consciousness. So energy is energy, consciousness is consciousness, not the same thing, but primordially non-dual. So if this energy is easy to access, I never said that, and send out during meditation, what's easy to send out during meditation is a visualization of light from your heart. That's easy to do, but that's not Buddha nature. Why can't we access it or reside in it more of the time or most of the time? Oh, you can visualize as much as you like, but it's still a visualization by the coarse mind. But we're doing a symbolic rehearsal, archetypal rehearsal of what takes place at a much deeper level. Voilà, so that was from Deborah. Here's one from Laura. I'm interested in how the five, that's a really good one, how the five factors of stabilization may help remove the five obscurations and where I might learn more about them. I think I must have addressed them. Do you remember K? I think it came up pretty explicitly in the Meditations of a Buddhist Skeptic. I'm pretty sure it's there. When I unpack Shamatha Vipassana from the Indian sources and then Dzogchen, I think I can... It might be there, but I suspect... I mean, this is just one of my books. My books are very late, and I haven't even published yet. Classic Theravada tradition, it's probably there in, what's it called? Tranquility and Insight by, what's the name of that, Burmese bhikkhu? Very good scholar. Nobody knows? Aidan. Doesn't ring a bell? I mean, he's really quite well known, right? Just right now, tip of the tongue. In any good, it might actually be there online in shamatha.org, our website. Shamatha.org, there's this wonderful book on Samatha and Vipassana in the Pali Canon by Kiminda Teta. And the whole book is online. And it's really outstanding scholarship. And he unpacks Samatha with great precision, shows the relationship with Vipassana, and shows why the first jhana is really necessary. You can't skip it. It was a misinterpretation to skip it. But this is such a rich question, I will come back to it. But since our time is so short today, I want to give that bit more time. Oh, there's a long one. Let's see if there's a short one. Here's a short one. Could you say more about the difference of resting in the substrate and the clear light nature of mind? Yep, pretty much the same as before. Resting in the substrate consciousness is resting in a conditioned state of consciousness. And of course you can rest there when you're just deep asleep. Then you're resting in the substrate. You don't know it because your awareness is veiled. It's not out. It didn't go zero. But it's as if you turn off a stove and all that's left is the pilot light. But it's hidden so you can't even see that, right? So there is consciousness, but it's really subliminal consciousness. So you can access it that way. You can take a general anesthesia. That will get you to rest in the substrate. You can die. All you have to do is wait for that one. But to have it be clearly illuminated, then you can access it the easy way without full depth is to be lucid in a dream, stop in the dream, be in the midst of a lucid dream, and then just stop. Close your eyes. Stop doing anything. Don't move your body. within a matter of seconds, the whole dreamscape will vanish. And your mind will slip from dreaming consciousness into dreamless consciousness. And then you can experience a such dream. With some light. With some luminosity. But not nearly the luminosity as if you did it the old-fashioned way with, you know, transcending or moving along the 9 stages of shamatha. But when you've achieved shamatha, then of course, bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality, whereas resting in clear light nature of mind is resting in the unconditioned. A dimension of consciousness that is not known even by an arhat while he's alive. So it's very easy, you know, to go out for a weekend Dzogchen retreat, and then afterwards say, oh, now I'm resting in Rigpa. And maybe you are. What do I know? But if an arhat isn't, while he's still alive, you might want to think twice about that. Because the arhat is still resting in coarse mind or subtle mind. And it's only when those two have vanished. This is a special. Maybe I'll just linger there a little bit. Vajrayana, highest yoga tantra. Stage of completion practice. There are no references that I know of to pristine awareness, but there are plenty of references to the innate mind of clear light. So we go to Tsongkhapa tradition, the new translation schools. It's not just Tsongkhapa. It's the Kagyut tradition, the Sakya tradition, new translation schools. They'll speak of innate mind of clear light, which you access, you gain direct realization of by way of stage of completion practice. And that entails completely shutting down this whole array of conceptual modes of conceptual cognition. They all have to go flat, down. And so it's like a seesaw. You have to take the coarse mind and the subtle mind, and you have to turn it off completely. And that means getting those energies to come into the central channel and into the indestructible bindu in the central, in the heart chakra. You need to get all of the coarse energies to stop, and you need to get the coarse and subtle mind to go completely dormant. And when they're completely shut down, through a lot of effort, pretty formidable practice, stage of completion, 6 yogas in Naropa, not easy. You need to get them to shut down completely, like the seesaw coming down completely. And when they are completely shut off, then the clear light, innate mind of clear light, can manifest. But one has to turn off before the other turns on. To be manifest, to be known, to be ascertained. And that's what the stage of completion is for. And the stage of preparation, the stage of generation is to prepare you so that the stage of completion can really work fully. Again, you can, a lot of people do, either skip or kind of just go ho-hum, just do some practice of stage of generation and then leap off and go and start doing tummo or other stage of completion practices. You can do that. A lot of yogis do it. But according to Tsongkhapa, and I rely on him heavily here, unless you've really perfected the stage of generation, you will not perfect the stage of completion. So can you develop a lot of heat? Can you dry off towels, you know, wet rags or wet, what do they call them, sheets? Yes, you can. But if you've not really fully realized stage of generation, the stage of completion will not be fully realized either. Can you get some realization? Yeah, but we're back to the same old, some realization, but it won't come to full flowering because you didn't do all the groundwork needed for which the stage of generation is designed. So, short answer, in this classic developmental approach, you need to completely turn off, just like a light, turn off coarse mind, nowhere in sight, turn off subtle mind, nowhere in sight, and then the innate mind of clear light can manifest. And that's what stage of completion is for. And Dzogchen is not like that. You don't necessarily have to engage in all of these very formidable practices. You may, and they're certainly helpful, but you don't necessarily have to engage in these practices of stage of completion to realize Rigpa. And moreover, you don't need to completely turn off, that is, completely immobilize, totally silence the coarse mind and the subtle mind in order to realize Rigpa. That's different. It's a different strategy. It's a different framework. And the deal is, you realize Rigpa, and then you perceive, from that perspective, the displays of coarse mind and even subtle minds as nothing other than creative displays of Rigpa. So you don't have to turn them off, you can see them simultaneously, viewing them all from the perspective of Rigpa. That an arhat can't do. that an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't do without Vajrayana practice. If your practice has been straight Mahayana, and pretty formidable Mahayana, gaining realization of emptiness with coarse mind or subtle mind, realizing bodhicitta, becoming an Arya Bodhisattva, that's pretty formidable, right? Arya Bodhisattva, direct realization of emptiness. With what mind are you realizing emptiness? Subtle mind. Not very subtle mind. Not innate mind of clear light. That you access by state of completion. Practice. Not just sutrayana. Not until you've finished. So that's the big deal about Vajrayana. Is that whether by state of completion or whether by Mahamudra or Dzogchen practice, you are viewing reality from the perspective of unborn, unconditioned, timeless consciousness that dwells in the fourth time beyond past, present, and future. You have a perspective on reality even an Arhat doesn't have. You have a perspective on reality even an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't have. If that Arya Bodhisattva is purely practicing Sutrayana. You're viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa, which an Arya Bodhisattva may not have, and an Arhat doesn't have, until he's passed away. So maybe Rigpa is not that easy, if an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't realize it, without Vajrayana. So I think sometimes we presume too much. Did you say the substrate consciousness is in the body? You were speaking about dying. If so, could you say more? Good question. Interesting question. We have time for it. Nice question. And I love the real quick, crisp, short ones. Yes and no. That is consciousness in the body? If you're resting in substrate consciousness and you look out, you're like, where am I? Do you see your heart? Do you see your lungs? Oh, tummy, intestinal tract. No, don't think so. Well, if you're in your body, you should. I mean, you're in there. I mean, if you look around, if that's your nearest neighbor, like lungs, give me a break here. So in that way, no. All of your experiences of the body are taking place within the substrate. Where are all appearances arising? Whether you're in samadhi, whether you're asleep, whether you're dreaming, or whether you're in the waking state. Right now, all the appearances of the mind center, this meditation hall and so forth, where are all these appearances? Where are they located? Not the atoms in the walls. They're located out there, of course. Somebody built them. Those atoms have a history independently of your mind continuum. That's clear. We don't need to be here for this room to be here, right? So it has a history independent of us. But I'm not talking about molecules and atoms. I'm talking about the appearances arising to you right now. Where are those appearances? Okay. Yeah, more specifically. Not the result of. I want to know location. Where are they? Where are they? Anybody. I don't mean to pinpoint. I don't mean to push pressure. Danny, where are they? Real quick answer. In the Alaya. Yeah. All appearances are arising in the Alaya. Now, where's the Alaya? But that's it. When you're in the substrate in deep sleep, and then something breaks the symmetry of just this amorphous, homogeneous experience of substrate, breaks the symmetry, and suddenly you're someplace in a dreamscape, and you are somebody, and you're attending to other people. Where are all those appearances located? In the substrate. They came from the substrate, they're located in the substrate, and that dissolved back into the substrate when the dream is finished. And likewise, and now this is straight from Dzogchen Lingpa. Likewise, and in no less degree, when you wake up from deep sleep, and you wake up and you see your room, where are all of these appearances arising from? It's a legitimate question. Where are they coming from? Are they seeping out of atoms? Are they actually, you know, coming out of photons, out of molecules and so forth? Are appearances actually coming out of chemicals? That's, I think, just bad physics. Things do emerge out of chemicals. Physical stuff, you can measure them. Chemical stuff, like neurons, do have properties. They have mass, they have charge, they have chemical composition. They have a lot of our properties. But not one of those properties of a neuron is an image or an emotion. I mean, really, think about it. You've got a ganglia of neurons, and they have mass, they have charge, they have chemical composition, and they have emotions. There's just something wrong with that language. But they have all of those, and there's just something wrong with that language to say that neurons have emotions, like they have mass, velocity, and so forth. That's just bad language. And it's even worse language to think that somehow emotions come out of neurons. Things do come out of the neurons. Electricity comes out of the neurons. But emotions? Oh, really? Come on. This has got to be a joke. Somebody's got to be joking here. That mental images come out of neurons? Who's ever seen, who dreamed up this stuff? It's worse than science fiction. It's bad science fiction. I think emotions are actually coming out of chemicals. Give me a break. I mean, I'm flabbergasted. I'm sorry I'm being deprecating, but it just seems so silly. So silly. Things come out of chemicals. They're called chemicals. They're called energy, and they're called mass. That's what comes out of chemicals. Physical stuff that you can measure. Emotions you cannot measure physically. Thoughts, appearances, you cannot measure physically. You can certainly measure them, but with consciousness alone. So, where do all these appearances come from? They come from the substrate. Where are they present in the substrate? Where did they dissolve into the substrate? That's it. All these appearances you see right now are all taking place, as Kay said, in your mind, but more explicitly, in the substrate. And when you fall asleep, those appearances aren't waiting for you. Like, you know, and red is just saying, I'm waiting. Ah, there I am. No, there's no red when you close your eyes. There's no red out there. There are molecules that your room is made of. Of course, that goes without saying. But the appearances, the smell of your room, the colors of your room, the sounds, the hum of the room, the air conditioning, what have you, those appearances are not out there waiting for you. They're not out there at all. They're in the space of the mind. They're in the substrate consciousness. That was a response, I'm sure, to something. So resting in the substrate, yeah. Oh, is this one? Ah, so that being the case, if all of these appearances are actually located in the substrate, and that means all your appearances of your body, including when the brain surgeon opens up your head, cracks your skull open to repair an aneurysm or something, all the appearances of your brain, pop quiz, they just popped open your head. And they're looking at your brain and they're fixing an aneurysm. Where are all the appearances of your brain? Where are they located? As you're anesthetized and the surgeon is repairing your brain and doing wonderful surgery, where are the appearances of your brain taking place? In the substrate of the surgeon. That's right. They're not inside your head. Right? So, surgeon's really getting inside your head. The appearances are not inside your brain. All the appearances of the brain are inside your substrate. So in this regard, to think your substrate consciousness is inside your body doesn't make any sense. All appearances of your body are in the substrate. So how could the body be in that which in which they are I think you got the message, right? Doesn't make any sense. But I have said, okay, visualize the Buddha nature, what have you, in your heart. What is true, according to Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and we'll end here with a couple of questions left over for tomorrow, and that is, are there subtle energies in the body that are directly correlated to or of the same nature as substrate consciousness? Substrate consciousness is non-physical. Being non-physical, to locate it in physical space is going to be really problematic. Where is justice? When a criminal comes to trial, and the criminal has done something wrong, and he gets judged, and the verdict is correct, and he gets a reasonable penalty or kind of punishment for it, and you say, justice was done. Good. Where's justice located? Exactly where is it? Right. Where's fame located? If something's not physical, to place it in physical space, is a categorical error. Justice is not physical. Therefore, it doesn't have location, not inside a courtroom, not outside the courtroom, not inside a neuron, not outside a neuron. It's not physical, so don't put it in physical space. It's a categorical error. Substrate consciousness is not physical. To place it in physical space doesn't make any sense. It's strongly correlated with and of the same nature as a continuum of subtle energy, prana, and that prana is physical and it's located in space and it's located in the heart chakra. And that's why Tibetans always, when they point to their mind, they point to their heart. Because that's where your mind comes back to. That is, it's like a yo-yo. It pops up to the head, pops up the throat, pops different places. But when it comes to rest, as in deep sleep, as in shamatha, as in dying, it converges. The energies converge to the heart chakra. And so in that regard, the energies correlated with substrate consciousness are located inside the heart chakra in the center of your chest. So that's physically located. And since substrate consciousness and is correlated, subtle energies are of the same nature. You can't pull one apart and look at one independently, or that one here, one there. In that regard, loosely speaking, kind of poetically speaking, one can say substrate consciousness is located in your body and is inside the heart chakra. And that's poetry. So. Then I listened to myself and I said, he must know what he's talking about. Don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. Enjoy your dinner. See you tomorrow.